We have a lot of information to cover today, and I'm not sure I have time to go back and revamp what we discussed last week. So what I want to do is, instead of having a scripture reading outside of the text that we're studying, I want to read the first 9 verses of Daniel chapter 5, which is what we looked at last week. And that will have to serve as our review. So this is beginning with Daniel 5, chapter 1. Belshazzar the king held a great feast for 1,000 of his nobles, and he was drinking wine in the presence of 1,000. When Belshazzar tasted the wine, he gave orders to bring the gold and silver vessels which Nebuchadnezzar his father had taken out of the temple, which was in Jerusalem, in order that the king and his nobles, his wives, his concubines, might drink from them. Then they brought the gold vessels that had been taken out of the temple, the house of God, which was in Jerusalem. And the king and his nobles, his wives, and his concubines drank from them. They drank the wine and praised the gods of gold, silver, bronze, iron, wood, and stone. Suddenly the fingers of a man's hand emerged and began writing opposite the lampstand on the plaster of the wall of the king's palace, and the king saw the back of the hand that did the writing. Then the king's face grew pale and his thoughts alarmed him. His hip joints went slack and his knees began knocking together. The king called aloud to bring in the conjurers, the Chaldeans, and the diviners. The king spoke and said to the wise men of Babylon, "Any man who can read this inscription and explain its interpretation to me will be clothed with purple and have a necklace of gold around his neck and have authority as third ruler in the kingdom." I will stop and point out that we spent some time on this concept of third ruler, and I gave you a little historical background that explained that Belshazzar, who is called the king here, was actually co-regent with his father Nabonidus, and therefore he could not offer the second place in the kingdom because he himself held that position. Then the king's wise men came in, but they could not read the inscription, and they could not make known its interpretation. And I believe those are two different things, two different challenges. They couldn't read it. They couldn't interpret it. Then King Belshazzar was greatly alarmed. His face grew even paler, and his nobles were perplexed. So this brings us to today's text, and I'm going to begin at this point with the first section of what we're going to discuss today, which involves verses 10 through 16. So we'll continue our reading. At this point, the queen entered the banquet hall because of the words of the king and his nobles. The queen spoke and said, "O king, live forever. Do not let your thoughts alarm you or your face be pale. There's a man in your kingdom in whom is a spirit of the holy gods. And in the days of your father, illumination, insight, and wisdom, like the wisdom of the gods, were found in him. And King Nebuchadnezzar, your father the king, appointed him chief of the magicians, conjurers, Chaldeans, and diviners. This was because an extraordinary spirit, knowledge and insight, interpretation of dreams, explanations of enigmas, and solving of difficult problems were found in this Daniel, whom the king named Belteshazzar. Let Daniel now be summoned, and he will declare the interpretation." Then Daniel was brought in before the king. The king spoke and said to Daniel, "Are you that Daniel who is one of the exiles from Judah whom my father the king brought from Judah? Now I've heard about you, that a spirit of the gods is in you, and that illumination, insight, and extraordinary wisdom have been found in you. Just now the wise men and conjurers were brought in before me that they might read this inscription and make its interpretation known to me, but they could not declare the interpretation or its message. But I personally have heard about you, that you're able to give interpretations and solve difficult problems. Now, if you're able to read the inscription and make its interpretation known to me, you'll be clothed with purple, wear a necklace of gold around your neck, and you'll have authority as the third ruler in the kingdom." Verses 10 through 16 give us the account of the summoning of Daniel to the palace, where the writing obviously still remained on the wall of the banquet hall. Last week we talked about the descendants of Nebuchadnezzar. He was survived by three children that we know about, a son named Amel-Marduk, who ascended to the throne, the death of Nebuchadnezzar, his father. He had an unnamed daughter who married Nergal-Sharezer, who was the successor to Amel-Marduk and therefore the son-in-law of Nebuchadnezzar. And then he had a daughter named Nitocris. She was a second daughter who married a man named Nabonidus. The king then appointed, the king being Nabonidus, because he was absent from Babylon, he was down in Arabia for many, many years, he appointed his son Belshazzar as co-regent during his extended absence from Babylon. What this means is that the mention of the queen in verse 10 is likely Nitocris. Her name is spelled Nitocris. She would have been the wife of Nabonidus, Belshazzar's father, and therefore Belshazzar's mother. It's kind of interesting. There are three reasons I think this identification is correct. The first one is mentioned in verse 3. It seems that the wives of Belshazzar were already present in this banquet hall, and they were already participating in the debauchery of the evening's festivities. Yet this queen was not there, indicating she wasn't one of the wives. She came to the party only after hearing what had taken place, it seems, indirectly from a third party. More convincing than that to me is it seems that her apparent knowledge of events that took place during the reign of Nebuchadnezzar were not secondhand information to her. It seems as though she had firsthand knowledge of things that occurred back then. For example, if you compare the language of chapter 4, verses 8, 9, and 18 to the language that she uses in chapter 5, you find that she's using some very similar language to the language that we find occurring back in the time of Nebuchadnezzar. For example, she references the Babylonian name of Daniel, Belteshazzar, in verse 12 of chapter 5. This matches with chapter 4. She attributes Daniel's abilities to the spirit of the holy gods, which is a phrase that was used to describe Daniel many years earlier, recorded in chapter 4. Like Nebuchadnezzar, she uses there the plural form of the Aramaic word for God. And I pointed out in a previous lesson that unlike in Hebrew, in Aramaic, if you are going to refer to the true God, the Almighty, the Most High, you always, without exception, use the singular form of the noun for God. That's not the case in Hebrew, but it is one of the differences in Hebrew and Aramaic. And finally, the third reason is this. She enters the presence of the king with a level of confidence that I don't think one of his younger wives would have had. She walks in without concern for protocol. I believe one of the young women of the harem at least would have hesitated to bring this up to the king, particularly at a time of stress and difficulty. But a mother would not hesitate to intervene. I can assure you mine would not have hesitated in the least. Her presence would have been there. So I think this is the queen of verse 10 is the daughter of Nebuchadnezzar, Nitocris. Now she enters into this banquet hall. That's how most of the translations read here. It's actually Beit Mishtayah. That means literally the house of drinking. What this tells us is this was not a stately affair. What's happening in this room is a drunken orgy, which explains to me why Nitocris and Daniel are not present. Despite being his mother, Nitocris walks up and addresses the king. She has poise. She does this with dignity, even though she must have been quite disgusted at what she saw when she entered the room. Then she gives us the reason for coming into the presence of the king. It was to offer a suggestion that might contribute to the interpretation of this inscription, and her advice is very simple. Go get Daniel. Bring him in. Verses 11 and 12 specify this particular advice that she gives. We know from chapter 8, verse 27, that Daniel still retains some responsibilities within the government. I can't prove this, I suspect that as an older man he's probably semi-retired, but he still has some responsibilities because in chapter 8, verse 27, we read that after a period of illness, he says he resumed, what's the word here? He re-engaged the duties assigned to him, which he refers to as the king's business. So he probably wasn't as prominent in the court of the king at this point as he had been under Nebuchadnezzar, but he's still there. I would not be surprised if Belshazzar had some loose knowledge of Daniel, although he didn't know him to the degree that Nebuchadnezzar did. Now, Nitricus uses a particular word to describe Daniel to the king when she says, "There is a man." She uses an Aramaic noun, Givar. Givar is one of several Semitic terms that can mean man. This particular word has its origin with a verb that means to be strong or mighty. Now, think about this. Daniel is not a young man at this point. This is occurring in 539 BC. Daniel was taken captive by Nebuchadnezzar in 605 BC. He was probably 14 to 17 years old at that time, I think more like 17. That would mean that at the time that this handwriting appeared on the wall, Daniel would have been somewhere between 80 and 85 years old. So when she says he's a hero, he's a mighty man, she can't be referring to his physical strength. She must be referring to his spiritual strength and his character. And I think this is further evidence of a long-standing friendship that had developed between Daniel and Nitricus that goes back to the time of Nebuchadnezzar. The queen spends some time here in these verses reminding her son of the family history that he has with Nebuchadnezzar, the relationship of Nitocris to Nebuchadnezzar, and the relationship of Nitocris to Belshazzar. So she's trying to link all this up so that he can see that his situation right now has some parallels in history. And you've probably noticed in here a time or two where she has referred to Nebuchadnezzar as Belshazzar's father. In both Hebrew and Aramaic, the word for father can mean father or grandfather or even descendant in some cases. And the word son, I should say father or grandfather or predecessor, and son can mean son in our use of the term, or it can mean grandson. So she's using this properly, but we have to understand Nebuchadnezzar was Belshazzar's grandfather, not his father. So she's emphasizing this link. She also emphasized that Daniel was considered worthy of a very high rank in the court and administration of Nebuchadnezzar. The fact that she says this man is still in your kingdom supports the idea that Daniel is still in some way involved, maybe in a semi-retired fashion, with the work of the court. She then recounts for Belshazzar the reasons Nebuchadnezzar promoted Daniel to such a high office. He's characterized by enlightenment, understanding, and wisdom. In verse 12, she says, "This is due to the fact that he has an excellent spirit, knowledge, and understanding that enables him to interpret dreams." She adds knowledge to this list of attributes that she's been giving, implying that the mind of this man, this 85-year-old man, Daniel, is full of information that is relevant to what's happening and is certainly likely to be useful in this present situation, which you might call a crisis. But even more to the point, she says to the king, he can explain enigmas. The word for enigma here is the word for riddle. It's the same word that appears in its Hebrew form in the story of Samson posing a riddle to those at his wedding party. This tells us that she sees this not only as this difficult inscription to read, but that there must be an element of it that is like a riddle, and in that she will prove to be exactly correct. She refers to in this Daniel, which is identifying first the man in question. She calls him first by his Hebrew name, and then by his Babylonian name, Belteshazzar. The fact that she referred to him first as Daniel, I think, is another indication that these two knew each other and they've known each other for a long time. And she probably knows something about his theology. Well, when he comes into the king's presence, verse 13, we see here that Belshazzar has listened to his mother, which is always, by the way, good advice. He says, "Are you that Daniel?" He doesn't say, "Are you Daniel?" He says, "Are you that Daniel?" He is condensing all this history that Nitocris, his mother, has just recited for him. "Are you that Daniel about whom all these things that I've just heard are true?" I've thought about this meeting a lot. and how different it must have been from that other meeting in chapter 2 with Nebuchadnezzar. Daniel was a young man at the time. I'm sure you remember the tension of that first meeting with the old king. Daniel was summoned before Nebuchadnezzar, and his head was at stake. Remember that? Daniel and his friends spent the night before the meeting in prayer for their lives. This Daniel of chapter 5 is not the same Daniel. He's not the same Daniel in the sense that he has now experienced a lifetime of experiencing God's faithfulness. God's faithfulness in an environment and in circumstances that are extremely difficult for us to even fathom. He's an old man. He's been in Babylon since he was 17 years old. And he has this whole lifetime of experiencing the faithfulness of God. And that means he's not the same Daniel. Now, Daniel was a faithful young man 60 years before. But I think when he came to this meeting, I don't think there was the slightest bit of anxiety. I don't think he was afraid of Belshazzar. I don't think he was concerned about what might happen to him. If he had any concerns, it's not reflected in anything that he said, in any words that he spoke to the king. So the king had asked a question, "Are you that Daniel?" But then if you notice, he doesn't actually give Daniel an opportunity to answer the question. He knew who this was. He knew exactly who he was. But he says, "Are you that Daniel?" And he immediately begins to affirm for Daniel what Nitocris, his mother, has told him about him. In verses 14 through 16, Belshazzar's repeating what Nitocris just told him. He mentions two qualities in this recitation that he considers to be important. The first one is Daniel's characterized by enlightenment, understanding, and wisdom, the same list of attributes that his mother had mentioned earlier. And he possesses, in his terms, the spirit of the gods. Again, he uses here the plural, which means that in the mind of Belshazzar, he's referring to the gods of the Babylonian pantheon, not to the god of Daniel. The next thing the king recounts for Daniel is the failure of the Chaldeans to read the inscription and to explain the meaning of the inscription. I mentioned last week that I think these are two completely different challenges. The wise men of Babylon can neither read nor interpret the inscription. And in just a minute, I'm going to explain why I think that is. In verse 16, we see the traditional offer of fame and fortune. This seems to be commonplace with these old kings. They had money to burn, and they could always give authority to people under them. And so he offers to Daniel what we might call a bribe. If you will read this inscription, then here are all the things I'll give you. Of course, gold and purple garments and a promotion to the third position of authority in a kingdom that Daniel knows is destined to fall this very night can't have meant a lot to Daniel. I know Daniel must have glanced at the inscription when he walked in. And he knows what it says. He didn't have to have a long time to think about this. He knows what's about to happen to the king. So the king is giving him all these promises, and Daniel just doesn't care. All right, let's look at verses 17 through 28, where we get into the really fun part of this chapter. Verse 17. Then Daniel answered and said before the king, tell me this doesn't sound different than when he spoke to Nebuchadnezzar 66 years earlier. Keep your gifts for yourself and give your rewards to someone else. Do you think he's afraid of this guy? Not in the least. Keep your stuff. I don't want it. However, I will read the inscription to the king, and I'll make the interpretation known to him. I think his words must have kind of surprised the king. He's not used to being talked to like this. What he's essentially saying to the king is, you don't have one thing that interests me. All your money, all your power, the rule that you exercise over this kingdom, it's not worth, as we would say, a plug nickel. Not many people are willing to walk up in front of one of these kings and say something like that, but Daniel did. He did it for a reason. Actually did it for three reasons. First, he's making clear to the king that Daniel's interests don't lie with the things in this world. We see an echo of this same mental attitude when Satan tried to entice Jesus by offering him all the kingdoms of the world if you'll but fall down and worship me. Both Jesus and Daniel responded by asserting that the important things of this world are not the things that the world considers important. The important things are spiritual. The second thing that his response to the king does is it prepares the king for the hard fact that in a few hours these things aren't going to mean anything to him either. His life is about to change dramatically. And finally, the third reason was to eliminate any possibility that Daniel's interpretation could possibly be influenced by anything the king could offer him. God had put Daniel before Belshazzar to deliver a message, not to receive gifts. Daniel's service to the king would be pro bono, free of charge, no compensation required. The revelation of the mystery begins in verse 18. Daniel begins with a reference to Nebuchadnezzar. He says, "The Most High God granted the kingdom, grandeur, and majesty to him, your grandfather." If you follow the pattern that was laid out earlier, Daniel uses the singular form here of the word for God. He says, "The Most High God," the Elah, not the Elohim, which would be the plural Aramaic, but Elah. He's referring to the true God, the Most High God, the one true God, the God that he worshipped and has worshipped his entire life. It is this God who bestows sovereignty, who establishes kingdoms, and who sets up human governments, and it is he alone who granted to your grandfather Nebuchadnezzar all that he had. The reason Daniel mentions Nebuchadnezzar is to establish a parallel between Belshazzar and his grandfather. Nebuchadnezzar was steeped in his own pride, and like him, Belshazzar has acted in pride by retrieving these golden vessels from the temple and using them for idolatrous purposes. The grandfather had been brought down by the god of the people he had persecuted. So like him, the grandson will be brought down by this same god whose name was profaned by the actions of the king. Daniel points out to Belshazzar that the absolute control and power his grandfather had over his people was absolute, and yet it was God-given. He tells Belshazzar, "Everyone trembled in fear of your grandfather, and for good reason, because he killed anyone he wanted to kill for any reason that he wanted to kill them. Who wouldn't be afraid of this man?" But what he's really emphasizing here is the central power that Nebuchadnezzar had, and it must have caused Belshazzar to take note of his own situation. Nebuchadnezzar had at his command the entire power of the empire, and still God was able to take him down. Belshazzar, his grandson, on the other hand, is co-regent. His power is given to him by Nabonidus, his father. So his position in terms of power is inferior to the position that Nebuchadnezzar sat in. Perhaps his fate would be even worse than Nebuchadnezzar's. Then guess what? It is. Well, we read about Nebuchadnezzar's sins in verses 20 through 21 that led to his fall. Daniel recounts these for Belshazzar. He says his heart was lifted up, not in a good way, but in a prideful way. His spirit became proud so that he acted and behaved arrogantly. Then he was deposed from his throne and his glory was removed from him. But we know from chapter 4 that it got worse, for this once powerful king fell because of his own pride. Here are the consequences of his sins. He was driven away from men, and his heart became like that of a beast, so that he dwelled among the wild beasts as one of them, and he ate grass like an animal. But this wasn't new information. Surely Belshazzar knew this. I can't imagine that he didn't. But he had learned nothing from the example of his grandfather. Daniel then proceeds to catalog the sins for which Belshazzar alone is responsible. "You've not humbled your heart, but you've set yourself up against the Lord of heaven. You profaned the golden temple vessels from Jerusalem. You praised the gods of silver, gold, bronze, wood, and stone. You did not honor the one true God." Daniel closes these accusations against the king by saying, "But the God in whose hand your very life breath is held, you have not glorified." in his pride, which is what is meant by you've exalted yourself, this young king reminds the reader of the central character of Isaiah's taunt of the king of Babylon, recorded in Isaiah chapter 14. There we read words that sound terribly like Belshazzar. You said in your heart, I will ascend to heaven, I will raise up my throne above the stars of God, and I'll set on the mount of the assembly in the recesses of the north. I will ascend above the heights of the clouds, I'll make myself like the Most High. And like him, nevertheless, you will be thrust down to Sheol, to the recesses of the pit. Later in Daniel 8 and then over in chapter 11, we'll see this pride magnified in the person of the little horn. The little horn that grew as high as the host of heaven in Daniel 8, and who shall exalt himself and consider himself greater than any god in Daniel 11. Of course, the little horn represent Antiochus the Fourth historically, and in the tribulation, the Antichrist. The story gets interesting in verse 24, because the sins of Belshazzar have triggered a response from heaven. And it's important to understand that what's about to take place in Babylon was not really initiated by the Persians. It was triggered from heaven. Evidence of this result is the supernatural inscribing of the writing that was an announcement to Belshazzar of imminent judgment. The hand was sent to him from God, whom Belshazzar failed to honor and whose name he profaned in too many ways to even mention. So now we turn to that thing that you all came to Sunday school today to talk about, and that is the actual handwriting. And what I'm going to do, I've got a handout. Now this is the kind of stuff I think is fun. Verse 25, according to the Masoretic text, this is the Masoretic text. The Masoretic text is just the Hebrew and Aramaic Old Testament. According to the Masoretic text, the hand inscribed the following words: Mene, Mene, Tekel, Upharsin. Last week I pointed out that in verse 7, we see that the king and his cohorts had two problems. The inscription that was written on the wall could not be read by the Chaldeans, and the inscription could not be interpreted by the Chaldeans. These are two different things, and that's important to understand. You got to read it before you can interpret it. And what we are told is they could not read it, and they could not interpret it. So I need to say that on this point, acres and acres of trees have been slaughtered by scholars, commentators, and book publishers trying to resolve the riddle and the mystery of the handwriting on the wall. So I have to be honest. No one really knows the answers to the questions that naturally arise from reading this account in the Old Testament. I've thought about this for four decades, and what you're going to hear today are my conclusions. Does that mean that they are right? No, but they're my conclusions. I'm not claiming to have solved the mystery, but I think these conclusions are reasonable, and I think reasonable is about the best we're going to be able to do sometimes when we're looking at these Old Testament challenges. So let's go back and look at verses 7 and 8 real quickly. The king called aloud to bring in the conjurers, the Chaldeans, and the diviners. The king spoke and said to the wise men of Babylon, any man who can read this inscription and explain its interpretation to me will be clothed with purple, have a necklace of gold around his neck, and have authority of the third ruler in the kingdom. Then all the king's wise men came in, but they could not read the inscription. Notice that. Don't skip over that first part. They couldn't read it, nor could they make known its interpretation to the king. Okay, so Belshazzar summons in all of his wise men, and he offers rewards to anyone who can both read and interpret this inscription. Verse 8 tells us that the experts could not read the inscription or interpret it, and apparently neither could the king, who I'm certain was literate. Why could they not read it? One possibility is that the writing was in a language these experts didn't know. So, what are the most likely languages in which the inscription might have been written. And I'm just sort of making an assumption here. I've seen arguments that God wrote this in some language that was not a human language, that was just illegible to a human. And then Daniel came in and was given the ability to read it. I don't think that's the case at all. So let's ask the question, what are the most likely languages in which an inscription might be written in this context? Well, one obvious answer is Aramaic. Aramaic was the language of the people and everyone could read it. The problem with that is the script and the vocabulary would have been familiar to everyone at the feast. Furthermore, is it not true that when Daniel reads the inscription in verse 25, he does so in Aramaic? Mene mene tekel upharsin is Aramaic. But it was a widely known language, so why could they not read it if it were written in Aramaic? So it must not have actually said mene mene tekel upharsin in a script that could be read by the people. Another possibility is that it was written in Akkadian. But Akkadian was spoken and written throughout the area of Mesopotamia. It was widely known. We have correspondence between heads of state from Babylon to Canaan to Egypt that is written in Akkadian. The famous body of documents called the Amarna Letters, it was correspondence between Pharaoh Akhenaten and his regional governors that were scattered out through Syria and Canaan. And this correspondence between the Egyptian king and his governors is written in Akkadian. So the Amarna letters are written in Akkadian. They're not written in Egyptian, even though they are communiques among Egyptian people. That tells me that Akkadian was widely known, and it makes no sense to me whatsoever that this inscription were written in Akkadian, that there would not have been people in the court of the king who could have written it. They might not have been able to interpret it. They might not have been able to give the meaning, but they would have been able to read it, and therefore there would have been no need to say they couldn't read it. I don't think it was Aramaic. I don't think it was Akkadian. Well, there's one more possibility that I can think of, and that is that it was written in something called Paleo-Hebrew. Anyone here heard of Paleo-Hebrew? A couple of people over here. Paleo means old. Paleo means old. So when we say Paleo-Hebrew, we're talking about old Hebrew. I think this inscription was written in Paleo-Hebrew. Now, guess what? I'm in the minority. I'll address the objections to this suggestion in a minute, but first let me explain to you what Paleo-Hebrew is. And I'm sorry, this is going to get a little bit technical. What I want to focus on here is the script, the way letters are written, the way they're formed. Before the Babylonian captivity, the Jews used a 22-character alphabet that was almost identical to the Phoenician alphabet. It didn't look anything like what we think of today as Hebrew. The alphabet that we call the Hebrew alphabet today, when you look at the Masoretic text, this is the Aramaic alphabet. In the Old Testament, in the original language that we have today, all of the characters that are written in this language, whether it is Aramaic or Hebrew, are written in Aramaic characters. It's not that different from being able to write a Greek word in English letters. Okay? So, all of these letters, all the script, all of the characters that are in this book are Aramaic characters. Before the Babylonian captivity, the Jews all used Paleo-Hebrew. We have, for an example, a Leviticus scroll written in Paleo-Hebrew. If you want to look it up, it's 11Q, P-A-L-E-O-L-E-V. It comes from Qumran. The Aramaic alphabet, this alphabet, was adopted by the Jews after the Babylonian captivity because it was the alphabet that the second generation of Jews learned in Babylon. So if you had been moved to Greece for a couple of generations and you still spoke English, but you had learned the Greek alphabet, you could come back and write English in the Greek alphabet. That's what the Jews did. They went into Babylon. They learned the Aramaic alphabet. They forgot the Paleo-Hebrew alphabet. They continued to speak their own language of Hebrew, but they started writing it in Aramaic characters. So most of the old scrolls that we have are written in Aramaic characters. If you were able to go back and see what Moses actually wrote in the Pentateuch, it wouldn't look anything like what is in this Hebrew Bible. But the Hebrew language could be written in either alphabet, either in these square letters that you're used to seeing and calling Hebrew, which are really Aramaic, or in the old Phoenician type style of writing, which is Paleo-Hebrew. So what I'm proposing is that the answer to the question, why could they not read the inscription, is that it was written in an alphabet with which none of these people was familiar. But it was a script with which Daniel was intimately familiar and which existed in his day, and probably, we know Daniel had the scroll of Jeremiah. He's going to talk about it later in Daniel 9. So we know he had Jeremiah's scroll. Was it written in Paleo-Hebrew? Probably. The ones we have today, which are copies, much later than the time of Jeremiah, are written in the Aramaic characters. A bunch of scholars disagree with me. Shock. How dare they? There are two commonly raised objections to what I've just said. Here's the first one. They argued that the wise men of Belshazzar's court would have known Paleo-Hebrew. Really? Once I heard Harold Honer tell a guy, prove it. That's kind of what I want to say. Let me say this. I don't know if that's true or not. It may be true. Maybe Paleo-Hebrew was a commonly known international language, or maybe they knew Phoenician. But there are a couple of things that make me doubt this. First, the northern kingdom of Israel, which would have written things in Paleo-Hebrew, consisted of 10 of the 12 tribes of Jews, and it went out of existence in 722 BC, 216 years before this party. That leaves little Judah, home of two tribes, Judah and Benjamin, the smallest of the 12. Judah was small, they were weak. Judah had been a vassal state of the Assyrians and then to Pharaoh Necho of Egypt, and then she was conquered by a general, at that time Nebuchadnezzar, some 66 years earlier, and Jerusalem was destroyed, probably with a lot of manuscripts, 47 years earlier in 586 BC. I can understand how the language of this little country, this little insignificant strip of land, which is a tiny part of the little strip of land we call Israel today, might not have been the highest priority in the court of the king. You can forget a lot in 66 years. Trust me, I'm 66. The second common objection is this. When Daniel reads the inscription in verse 25, he reads it in Aramaic. Let's imagine that there is a Hebrew word written up there. Look at the one on the left, right above the word Aramaic. There's a Hebrew word written up there. It's written in Aramaic characters, but it's a Hebrew word. If you were to say to me, read that, please, I could respond to you two different ways. I could say, ufarsh. But if you've asked me to read something that you can't read, would you expect me to read it in a way you can't understand what I'm saying? Or would you prefer that I said, and the Persians? Well, you'd probably expect me to actually not read it, ufarsin, but to translate it. So when they make this argument that in verse 25 Daniel is speaking Aramaic, I'm not surprised. Here's an inscription on the wall no one can read or understand. And so they say, could you please read this for us? And he says, sure. Mene mene tekel ufarsin. That they can understand. So this argument that it must have been written in Aramaic because that's what we have in verse 25, my goodness, we're reading an Aramaic scroll. What do you expect to see? So I just don't think that is a very valid objection. And I haven't heard that many other ones. It's just typically dismissed that this is overly simplistic way to do it. Now, this thing I gave you, the second line, of course, read from right to left, is Mene Mene Tekel Ufarsin, written in the Aramaic language and the Aramaic script. That's the second line. And you'll notice there are no dots or dashes or squiggly things, which means there are no vowels. These are all consonants. What's written above it on the top line is what it would have looked like in Paleo-Hebrew. So you can see, even if you could read Hebrew and Aramaic script, if you didn't know Paleo-Hebrew, and you walked in and that top line were on the wall, you would have no idea how to read it, because it doesn't look anything like the language you can speak, read, and write. Now, Hebrew vowels. The Hebrew Old Testament, whether it's the Hebrew section or the Aramaic section, is written in consonants. Some people will say, well, so vowels didn't exist. It's like, well, no, they existed. They just didn't have any way of writing them. This will surprise some of you. It was not possible to write Hebrew vowels for over 1,000 years after this party. The Hebrew vocalic system, the ability to write Hebrew vowels, is something called the nikud. It means dots in Hebrew. Dots. It was developed between the 6th and 10th century A.D. because people were forgetting how to read Hebrew. It took 400 years because there were competing systems. And the cool thing about the way Hebrew writes vowels, and you can see some down in the second and third columns here, is with this block Aramaic script that the Bible is now being written in, gave you places to put them. You could put them inside these square letters. You could put them below them or above them. And you could make it possible for your children to read the Hebrew Old Testament. Just because you can't write a vowel does not mean vowels don't exist. Okay? You can't speak a word without vocalizing or pronouncing a vowel. They existed. They just didn't have a way to write them. So you've got to distinguish between the spoken language, what goes on in your head, what comes out of your mouth, and what gets written down on a piece of sheepskin. Vowels existed. You can't have a language without them. Speaking doesn't work without them. But they had no way to write them. So Hebrew speakers vocalized and said vowel sounds. They just didn't write them down. And people say, well, how in the world did you read this stuff? Well, all I can tell you is that they knew how to speak exactly the same way you know how to speak. What we're talking about here is writing. And of course, writing then drives reading. So I bring this up not to complicate our understanding of the story, which I've probably done, but it's actually because I want to clarify what's going on here. Because Daniel's interpretation of the writing involves rearranging the vowels that aren't written. So since vowels aren't written down, Daniel's got some poetic license here to do with them whatever he wants. And keep in mind, there's not a sentence here. A sentence would be a context in which you would know, oh, I need these vowels. This is not a sentence. These are words. And they have no vowels written. And there are different ways you can pronounce them depending on what vowels you assign to these consonants. So let's start with verse 25. He's asked to read the inscription. He looks at it. And he says, okay, here's what it says. Mene, mene, tekel, upharsin. As he speaks this, the phrase he says in Aramaic consists of three different nouns, one of which is repeated, and one conjunction. So what's recorded for us here is what he said. So let's do the easy part first. Let's dispense of the conjunction. The conjunction is the word and, okay? So, see that U, the beginning of the word on the left, upharsin? That's the word and. So, you could read this, mene, mene, tekel, and parson. The U is the word and. Don't worry about the I-N ending on parson. As Daniel pronounced these words, they're nouns. Furthermore, each of these words represents a unit of weight. Okay? As a noun, they represent a unit of weight, and since the value of money was determined by the weight of the money, each also represents a monetary value. Okay? As nouns, these three words represent a weight and a monetary value. So let's examine the three nouns. We'll start with verse 26. Daniel pronounces the first word, mene. Pronounced mene, the word is a noun that means mina. You've heard that word in Scripture. A mina is a unit of weight that equals 60 shekels. You've heard of a shekel? If you want to think about this in monetary terms, since money was weighed in order to determine its value, let's make this easy. We'll call the mene a dollar. And what I'm thinking of here is a silver dollar. So just think about a silver dollar. Verse 27, Daniel pronounces the next word, tekel. Tekel. Pronounced tekel, the word is a noun and it means shekel. Now, one of the oddities of Semitic languages is that certain consonants flip-flop between languages, and it just so happens that S's and T's flip-flop between Hebrew and Aramaic. So if I were to accentuate the word different, a tekel is a shekel. The T is the Aramaic expectation for a consonant that way. The Hebrew word for gold is zahav with a Z. The Aramaic term is dahav with a D. D's and Z's flip-flop. Hebrew-speaking person would call Nebuchadnezzar Nebuchadnezzar. An Aramaic-speaking person would call him Nebuchadrezzar. There actually is an occurrence of Nebuchadrezzar somewhere in the Old Testament. So these characters, these consonants can flip-flop back and forth. So a tekel is a shekel. It's the same word. Actually, I should say they're cognates. Remember we talked about cognates? Cognates are two words that have a common origin originally. So a tekel and a shekel, or a tekel and a shekel, are the same thing. And like a mina, the shekel is a unit of weight. It's lighter than a mina, so for our purposes, we're going to call it a dime. Okay? So we have a silver dollar and a dime. Now let's look at verse 28. Daniel pronounces the word in verse 28, peres. Peres. Pronounced peres, the word is a noun and it means a half mina. So we'll call this a half dollar. So you have a silver dollar, a dime, and a half dollar. Imagine that you are brought in to interpret this thing and you can read it and it says a silver dollar, a dime, and a half dollar. Going to be able to do much with that, are you? No. So we have a mina, a shekel, and a half mina, or a dollar, a dime, and a half dollar. Even if the Chaldeans could have read this, which we know they couldn't, they wouldn't be able to explain it because they had no way to interpret it. And one other thing to note is that since no vowels are written here, and since there's no context, like you would have in a sentence, it's very hard to figure out which vowels to supply anyway. So that's the problem. So we have to acknowledge at this point that even if I'm right about the inscription being written in Paleo-Hebrew, a script Daniel could read, but still without the guidance of the Lord's Spirit, he would have been unable to explain the riddle. Because all he would have seen is a silver dollar, a dime, and a half dollar. Verse 26, let's think about how Daniel interpreted this. Verse 26. Now notice how Daniel interprets the first term in verse 26. He says, God has numbered, he pronounces the word, mene, mene. And then he says, God has numbered your kingdom and put an end to it. How on earth did he arrive at that interpretation? Well, the first thing Daniel did is he shifted his thinking from the mina, the noun, from the mina as a monetary unit to the action that created the monetary unit. That is, instead of thinking noun, he shifts over and thinks verb. But it's not that simple, because there's one other thing. In Old Testament times, Semitic peoples loved to participate in what we call plays on words. Plays on words. Word plays appear throughout Scripture, but they're not obvious because you're reading Scripture in a translation. Let me give you a couple of quick examples. In Amos chapter 8, verse 2, the prophet, upon seeing a basket of summer fruit in Hebrew is kayitz, kayitz. Upon seeing a basket of kayitz, he announces the end, kates, of Israel. See the how kayitz and kates sound alike? It's a play on words. They do this all the time. There's an example in first chapter of Jeremiah where God shows Jeremiah the branch of an almond tree. It's a shakade. A shakade is the branch of an almond tree. And God says, I'm watching shakad over my word to perform it. Same consonants, just different vowels. A shakade and a shakad, a kayitz and a kates. They do this all the time. So it's not uncommon for us to run into word plays in the Old Testament. So Daniel does something different. We're talking about word plays here. Mene is a mina, but there's another word, mana. See how they sound alike, mene and mana? They're written here. Middle column under noun, the first one up here, mene. And then look over to the right, one column, mana. Mene, mana, okay? One of the differences in mene and mana is mene is a noun that means mina, and mana is a verb that means to count or number. So he's playing this little word play game here. We have mene as a mina. We have this other word, mana, that's a verb, and it means to count or number. And notice it's accomplished by changing the vowels. Just listen to the sound, mene versus mana. And it is a word play because in this particular case, it is spelled a little bit. It's got a different consonant, which is maybe apparent to you as you look at that. But the sounds are similar enough that he can do this little word play thing. Verse 27. Notice how Daniel interprets the term in verse 27. He says, you have been weighed on the scale and found deficient. So he says, okay, tekel, a shekel, or in our case, a dime. And then he says, you've been weighed in the scale and found deficient. Well, following the same pattern we saw in the previous verse, if you change the vowels from tekel to tekal, notice the similarity, tekel, tekal, tekel, tekal. Instead of a noun shekel, you get a verb that means to weigh on a scale. Belshazzar, in all of his splendor, lacks the gravitas to be the king. You might say he's too light on God's scale. In fact, there's another little interesting wordplay that may come into play here. There's an Aramaic word called kilal, which means to be light. It's where we get the kal stem for you Hebrew guys. Kilal, to be light, sounds like to call. So he may be saying to him, you've been weighed in the scale and found to call. You've been found kalal. You've been found too light, not sufficient. And so there may be a word play involved there as well. And then we have verse 28. And notice how Daniel interprets the term here. He says, your kingdom has been divided and handed over to the Medes and the Persians. So once again, he says the noun, and he pronounces it in this verse, peres. Peres. It's a half mina, or in our case, a half dollar. And he's altered the vowel pattern from peres to peras. Peres, peras. And the noun becomes a verb, and that verb means to divide in halves, to cut into, to break into, or to divide. The root of this term is PRS. You see it throughout that third row across. Everywhere you look, there's a P and an R and an S with different vowels. It appears in verse 28 in three different ways. This is interesting. Verse 28. The first occurrence is at the beginning of the verse, and it's pronounced peres, half mina. Its second occurrence is a passive verb written in the PL or intensive stem where it's pronounced pirasat and translated divided. And then the third occurrence is the last word in the sentence, paras, which means Persians. So out of PRS, we have the monetary unit, a peres. We have the verb to divide, paras. And we have the Persians, paras. All built off of three Aramaic consonants. All three meanings are achieved by taking the same three consonants, PRS, and fooling around with the vowels. Remember, all these changes are made through vowel pattern changes and word plays. Daniel begins with a mina, a shekel, and a half mina, and by vowel alterations derives numbered, weighed, and divided. And then we have the bonus of PRS also being the root term of Persia, which you can see in the English word Persia. It's got those letters in it, where he gets this. So I've got a couple more comments about verse 28. The text says the kingdom will be divided and given over to the Medes and the Persians. Don't let this confuse you. This does not mean that Babylon is going to be divided in half, because that's what it kind of sounds like in English. Your kingdom is going to be divided and given to half of it to the Medes and half of it to the Persians. That's not what this means. What it means is this. Here's the sequence. Belshazzar's kingdom will be brought to an end, and then it'll be absorbed into the Medo-Persian Empire. Now you have to keep in mind what was happening in the broader context of the ancient Near East at this time. During the very early years of Belshazzar's reign, and certainly during Nebuchadnezzar and Amel-Marduk and the successors, the Medes were dominant over the Persians. The Medes were dominant. 550 BC. What's that, 11 years earlier than this. 550 BC, Cyrus the Great defeats the Medes. But these transitions don't occur overnight. Chapter 5 takes place in 539, 11 years after Cyrus has conquered the Medea. There's this process of infusing the Median Empire into the Persian Empire that's still going on in 539. So the sense in which Belshazzar's empire will be divided is it'll become part of the still divided Medo-Persian Empire. That's what this means. And there's something else that's interesting here. The fact that the word order Daniel uses is Medo-Persian instead of Persian and Medes argues for a date of authorship exactly when the book of Daniel claims to have been written. If you look at the book of Esther, see if you see a difference here. This is the book of Esther. This is written in 465 BC, so this is written 70 years later. In the third year of his reign, he gave a banquet for all his princes and attendants, the army officers of Persia and Medea. Why not Medo-Persian? That's verse 3. Verse 14. Seven princes of Persia, Medea. Verse 18. This day the ladies of Persia and Medea. And verse 19. Persia and Medea. The Medo-Persian Empire was only referred to as the Medo-Persian Empire for maybe 40 years. Why? Because during that transition period, the Persians were taking a dominant place over the Medes. But in the time of Daniel, when this was written in 539 BC or 537, Media was still somewhat dominant, even though Cyrus had a military victory over them. And so for a very short period of time, it was referred to as the Medo-Persian Empire. You never see it that way again in any literature. It's always the Persians and the Medes. So this is a subtle argument for an early date for Daniel. Because I'm convinced if this were written in 165, the way a lot of critics say it was, they may have simply said the Persians, because by that time there were no Medes, or they may have said the Persians and the Medes. So this is actually an argument for our more conservative date of authorship being early. We're going to read the rest of the chapter, which is just three verses, and I'm going to make about two comments, and then you can go home. Verse 29, then Belshazzar gave orders, and they clothed Daniel with purple and put a necklace of gold around his neck and issued a proclamation concerning him that said, you now have third position in the kingdom. And I'm sure he said, great. 30, that same night Belshazzar the Chaldean king was slain. So Darius the Mede, notice the Mede, received the kingdom at about age 62. So the prediction that came true this night is that Belshazzar was slain. And we've said last week, General Gobryas, remember the general of Cyrus's army came in, rerouted the Euphrates River, came in and took Babylon. Verse 31 then introduces us to Darius the Mede. Notice verse 31 says, he received the kingdom. He was not given the kingdom by birth or by royal succession. It was given and entrusted to him. Now, we're going to see more of him later, but for now, I'm simply going to tell you who I think Darius the Mede is, because there's a lot of dispute about this. I think Darius the Mede was General Gobryas, the general of the army of Cyrus the Great, who led the attack, successful attack, on Babylon. He was appointed ruler over the city he had captured by Cyrus a few weeks after the capture of Babylon. We'll talk about that more later. Thank you for your attention today during a rather technical lesson. Next week we'll begin chapter 6. I'll hang around if you have questions. Otherwise, let's have a quick word of prayer and we'll be dismissed.